You're listening to episode 5 of the Book Thingo podcast, featuring lively discussions about romance books, culture, and scrapbooking vampires. This is part 2 of a conversation with Ainsley Payton and Jodie McAllister, recorded on August 17, 2013, at the Romance Writers of Australia conference in Fremantle. Book Thingo would like to acknowledge the traditional owners and custodians of the land on which this episode was recorded, the Whadjuk people. We also acknowledge the contributions of Aboriginal Australians to our shared literary heritage.
Welcome to the Book Thingo podcast, talking about books we love, especially romance. Kill a fairy fast on the Book Thingo podcast.
Welcome back to the Book Thingo podcast. I'm Kat Mayo from bookthingo.com.au, an Aussie blog for romance readers. This episode is the second part of my meandering conversation with Ainsley Payton and Jodie McAllister. Ainsley writes contemporary romances, and you can find her work at Ainsley Payton, that's ainsleypaton.com.au. Jodie is a literary historian who has just submitted her doctoral thesis on virgin narratives in Western literature. Jodie is Book Thingo's Virgin Horny Pants specialist, and she is regularly found at the Momentum Moonlight blog, as well as her theatre review blog, Theatre from the Backseat. So in this episode, we talk about teen romance, Twilight's erotic descendants, and new adult fiction. Bear in mind, this was recorded in 2013, and there is a lot more diversity in new adult romance now. We also talk about various sexual fantasies we've read in erotic romance, and how well or not they translate in real life. Hypothetically speaking, we mull over the differences between traditionally published romance and self-published romance, especially those that began as serial fanfiction. We mention some academic terms that were covered in part one, such as demisexuality, but the short version is that in romance, love is a sexually transmitted disease that the hero catches from the heroine. Somewhere in the middle of the podcast, we talk about a Laura Kinsale book whose title we were unsure of. Jodie correctly identified the book, which was Prince of Midnight. You can find information on all the books we talk about in this episode by going to bookthingo.com.au/podcasts and clicking on episode number 5. The audio for this podcast was produced by Rudy Bremer, who is totes awesome.
Well, the classic example of a book where they don't have kids and that's okay is Bet Me by Jennifer Crusie.
Right.
I think. That's like the one that would immediately spring to mind for me when it's like, yep, Min and Cal, not having kids, but they're awesome. They're kicking it on and they really, really love each other.
Okay, but so there's the marriage and the kids. So they're getting one or the other.
They get married, I think, yeah. But they don't have kids. But
you don't ever get really hard romance to justify a happy ever after without the marriage. Really hard.
Yeah. So why?
I think people think you can just chuff off if you don't get married.
And I wonder if this is why there's a problem with the romance and the teen genre, because if you end a teen romance in marriage, it's kind of strange.
12.
Yeah, because when Bella and Ed get married, it's like, come on, guys, Bella's like 4 years old.
He's 3,000 years old.
Yeah. Did Jacob imprint on a baby? I mean, that's really gross.
I can talk about the weirdness is going on in Twilight.
I'm really annoyed. I'm so glad I only read the first two books, because in the second one, Edward was largely absent and I really enjoyed it. And then he came back and I was like, I'm not reading this anymore. And obviously I know she doesn't end up with Jacob.
Yeah.
And I had a feeling she was going to do a hatchet job on Jacob to justify the fact that Bella doesn't end up with him.
Jacob really gets arsy once Edward comes back. A bit of sexual assault going on there.
But he was so lovely to her in the second book.
Yeah, he's a cool dude. Yeah. And then she ruins him. And then he falls in love with the baby.
He caught something, but it wasn't love.
Well, Twilight is interesting because it's got those periods of abstinent resistance taking the place almost of sex scenes.
Right. Yeah.
And, resisting is itself eroticized. And
right.
It's so interesting, that text, which I think is why it has so many erotic descendants. Like, you look at 50 Shades, then that's just replaced with sex. Same with, it's that other one that you couldn't get through. You only read, 10 pages. Beautiful Bastard.
Oh, my God, the sexual harassment book.
Oh, man, when I first read that, I was like, are you serious right now?
Me too. Although I did read the sex scene to see if it was any good. It was really hot, actually. And I was so annoyed.
And that was the one with a lot of tearing of underwear, wasn't it?
Yeah, and yeah. I'm like, yeah. She has really expensive underwear.
Does he buy more underwear? I'm sure he does.
I'm sure he probably does. So, but she wears like La Perla, and it's like, that's so expensive.
And it's not that easy to tear underwear. It's like stretchy, you know?
And I feel like that would maybe hurt. Like,
and it all happens on the stairwell, from what I remember. So it was not
The second
one. A very comfortable.
Well, the second one is the stairwell. The first one is in the boardroom, and she's like pressed up against the window.
That was really hot. But the problem I had was it's sexual harassment, which I did not find hot at all.
Because there's no words. He just like starts groping her, and she just goes with it, even though she's been like, I hate him so much. Yeah. He is the worst.
I was really frustrated because I loved the I hate him so much part.
Yeah.
And I kind of really liked the sex part. I just didn't like where they intersected.
Yeah,
and
then which was like 10 pages in.
Yeah, exactly page 10. Because I tweeted it.
And did you read further than that?
No.
I read it all. And yeah, there were some bits where I'm like, no, this is okay, this is okay. And then I couldn't ever get over the sexual harassment in the first chapter.
It just needed a little bit in the middle to show that even though she kind of disliked him as a person, that she was attracted to him. But there was really no hint of that. And then suddenly he touched her leg.
Yeah.
And she's like, what the hell's going on? And then, ooh, we're having sex. This is...
I feel like that scene could have been really, really hot if there had just been that bit more character
development.
If it had happened like maybe a quarter or even halfway through the book.
But that's the anti-porn argument.
Well, I think the thing that upset me most is it felt so exploitative at the beginning. But I mean, I don't have a problem with early sex per se, just in this particular... text.
It was creepy.
It
felt creepy.
I can't remember it being creepy, but I remember when he got sick in the later, it was just like, that's a total whip out. Like, what's happening here?
Mm. I just remember at the beginning, it just felt really out of character for her to just go with it.
Right.
Even though it was like page 10, you know.
And the
she should have been smacking him in the face.
She should have been like, dude, what?
This job, so I must put up with it.
It's like, oh, that's creepy. That's
I must
really,
look at that again.
Creepy.
I can't actually remember that. Happening. Yeah. And it's a wonder I didn't have a reaction against that.
Have you read, is it Kristen or Kirsten Ashley?
Kristen Ashley. That's Kristen. Yeah. Kristen, yeah.
The Motorcycle Man?
I haven't.
Oh, yeah, you loved it, didn't you?
I loved it. It was great. It's cracky.
You might want to try it.
I have heard it has the crack.
It does, it does. And the interesting thing about her heroines mostly are, they are not lay down.
Yeah.
So she's alpha, extreme end of alpha, obnoxious extreme end of alpha.
Yeah.
But the heroines are not lay down. Unasteels. They are smart in their own ways. They know what they want. They might be a bit confused about something or other, but they stand up for themselves, and they're kind of feisty and clever.
Yeah,
which makes it much more even parallel. Got a much more interesting dynamic because of that. But there's still the one attachment thing that comes out of that. Mm. So there's kind of a taming element of the alpha hero gets a little bit tamed by the feminine influence.
You know, Catherine O'Reilly wrote this book. It's one of my favourites, called The Longest Night. And the heroine is like Samantha in Sex and the City, where she's very sexually active, very promiscuous. If she wants the guy, she will go and get the guy. So it's kind of a reverse, where the hero gives her the love disease. Because she kind of propositions the hero, and the hero turns her down. And she's like, this has never happened to me before. So she's the one in need of taming. And then when he comes back, because, you know, obviously he knew he was an idiot. And then they negotiate sort of when they would sleep together. And she's like, there are certain rules that I have. I don't dress up. I think she has, basically it's like she has to have an orgasm or it's, you know.
He's out.
And he has to produce a medical certificate for her. So it's really, it was like, this is not something, negotiation of like STDs and past sexual experience is usually just one line in a Mills and Boone.
Because kind of trying to get rid of it.
A feature of her, you know, this is what approach. I do. And then he, when they finally sleep together, he basically seduces her and he just won't let her get to her orgasm. And she's like, you know, and he's like, oh, you know, step one is this, step two. And she's like, when are we, can you just hurry up? And he's like, you know, be patient. And it's kind of the reverse, really. You know, the hero who, like, jumps on the heroine is ready to have sex, and then the heroine kind of mellows him down and, you know, he has to slow down because she's a virgin or whatever. She causes him to kind of not be so aggressive.
Is he a hidden alpha?
Starts
out being the beta boy and ends up mastering her.
Well, I think they're both alphas, actually.
Right.
But she's the one that has to get to that point where she feels ready, because she doesn't want to settle down with anybody.
So that sounds like a story about control and giving
partially,
up control.
I think so, yeah.
That narrative sounds like the fit, though, but the sex scene actually sounds quite conventional. That whole idea of the hero knows her body better and he will tell her when she's when she's ready.
That's
and he
true.
Will
yeah,
control
yeah.
it and yeah. be very, very slow. Yeah. Whereas, and like she's often the one that is overwhelmed by desire and is like jumping him. Yeah. And he's like, no, I am the sex master god.
Well, I do know that. Yeah, true.
That's true.
But if it becomes a satisfying piece of entertainment and it delivers functionally enjoyment from the text, does any of that matter?
No, not really. I don't think so.
Oh, and you know what? This one, the morning after, right? They wake up. You know, no, there's no morning breath in romance.
Yeah.
She wakes up. She's, like, completely horrified that there's this man next to her bed and she's got, like, last night's makeup. She's, like, bolts in the bathroom and basically tells him to get out of there. So, and
he was meant,
like,
to go home, was he?
Well, she only has one night stands. She never has people stay over.
Yeah.
And he's basically just, like, again, you're kind of amused at her. Mm. And she's like, this is horrifying, you know?
Yeah, it's definitely a control story.
Yeah.
And also, that sounds like so many new adult heroes I've been reading lately.
Oh, really?
They have so much sex. It's really, really weird.
My concerns, let's say, not problems, with new adult is similar to my concerns with YA, basically, that I find it quite shallow for first person and inauthentic in experience because I mean, obviously, you can have characters that are different per book, but generally, what I love about new adult is that sense of anything is possible, and that when you're in your 20s, you kind of you feel like you have a lot of power. It's not a time where you feel powerless about your life. It's a time where you feel like you can try new things, that you actually take more risks than you would have as a teenager, that, you know, you're not like a shy wallflower if you start that way, that you're not going to be like...
You kind of found yourself a little bit.
Yeah.
Even if you're not all the way there yet.
So what are you saying that...
Whereas a lot of what I read is kind of like, oh, you know, this guy, he's sleeping around, he must be a terrible guy. When I was in my 20s, that was not the primary thing that people were thinking if a guy was sleeping around. And girls weren't so prim, you know.
Is that some oddly imposed morality scheme?
I think that's what I find frustrating with the young adult and the new adult is that because the authors who are writing them are older, we're kind of they're dragging some of their
transplanted
minds,
morality or transplanted something
instead of being in the character and going if I were this character and talking as her, what would I do?
Are those books written not for a younger audience? Are they just younger characters written for an older audience?
Maybe.
I think it would depend. I've been reading a lot of new adult because I really want to find one that does university well. I haven't found one yet, and it's...
Well, when you find one, can you please
tell me? As in Australian university?
Any university. Really. Yeah.
God, there's so many college ones.
Have you read Gail Forman's... Where she went?
No, I think I have it on my Kindle, but I haven't read it yet.
So that's a good one. I don't think they're at university, but they're at that age. And the other one that I love is Melina Marquetta's.
I love that one. That is one that does university well.
Oh, my God.
And also because it's set in
so
Sydney.
Freaking good.
And like, they work in where, like, the union in Newtown. I'm like, I go there all the time.
But the added bonus is that not only is the setting familiar, you can see those people being in that setting.
Right.
So,
yeah.
The authenticity is there.
Because the problem with setting it, having something set somewhere you know, is if the characters don't feel like they belong there, it's very easy to tell.
The only one of hers that hasn't worked for me so much is Looking for Ella Brandy.
Exactly the same for me. But what about her fantasies?
I haven't read those ones.
Yeah, see, they don't work so well for me either.
Yeah.
But only because the first one really did me in because there was a background setting of war. And, you know, in war, the women invariably get treated the worst.
Yeah.
And some of the backstory just... like, so horrific that I couldn't stand it. And she writes so well, so when it's bad, it's really bad.
Yeah. My favourite one, which I adore. I love it so much. It's such a fey quality to On the Jellicoe Road. And
yeah, that book was interesting. I almost didn't finish it. I had to read the end. Once I read the end, I could go back. But the thing with that one is every time I read it, I enjoy it even more.
Yeah, oh, it's amazing. I've read it about 10 times.
I find more things that I missed the first time. And I go, oh, that's why this is important. This, like, two words in this sentence really related to that thing at the end that happened.
Yeah.
And when I first read it, I found it so... scary because they had these wars and Yeah. Really, I felt like someone was going to die and get killed.
Yeah,
they were
so intense.
Yeah, but it was just like an ordinary kind of biffo between different groups.
Yeah, there's like the kids that go to this private school.
Yeah.
They're like out in the country.
Yeah.
The kids that live in the towns, they're the townies, and these army cadets from a Sydney private school that come and stay there for 6 weeks every year. And then these big territory wars. And so each school has kind of the boss that is like their war leader. And so from the school is the heroine Taylor, and from the cadets is the hero, what's his name, Jonah?
Jonah Griggs.
Yeah. And then from the town there's
a bit dirty. He's only like 18.
And then from the town there's Chaz Santangelo, kind of got a secondary romance with the heroine's friend Raffaella. And it's exquisite.
I have to read this.
Oh, it's amazing. It's such a beautifully constructed book.
Yeah.
And yeah.
So why are the not so beautifully constructed books doing so well?
Oh.
Or do we just think they're doing well? I don't know. They do seem to be.
I think there's an appeal in books, stories that are just told, and that how they're told is how you consume them, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
So when you read On the Jellicoe Road, it's really complex, and it's actually...
It stands up to rereading really, really well.
And it can be hard to read it the first time.
Yeah.
But when you read something like 50 Shades, if the voice appeals to you, I should say, then you can read it straight through, and it's really... you can escape into it. And
50 Shades.
People read that over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. They were just reading the
well, 50 maybe they were.
But then 50 Shades gets abandoned so much as well. Like it floods back into bookstores.
I did not know it was the most abandoned text.
Yeah.
But that kind of made, just on sheer statistical volume, that makes sense.
But I feel like maybe a lot of the people who are rereading it don't have anywhere else to go in the genre because they don't know that it exists.
But the genre has catered for them by mass manufacturing knockoffs almost.
Yeah, it's true.
There's a whole layer of sub-50 stuff that's sitting there that's kind of on top of the more resonant stuff, and yet
I wonder how well they do the second wave of 50 Shades.
So like first generation Twilight is 50 Shades.
Yeah, 50 Shades, Beautiful Bastard, Wallbanger, Gabrielle's Inferno, the worst book in the entire world.
I read about that one too.
Yeah, from an academic perspective, I'm interested to see how this one text Twilight has been transformed in all these ways. And the congruences that happen between these texts. Like, I find it really interesting that in a few of them, the Bella characters, whether it's Anastasia Steele or, you know, whoever, her identity gets really, really fragmented and she starts talking to pieces of herself. You look at Wallbanger, she's got, like, 7 of them. There's so many. There's her head, her heart, her spine, her boobs, her vagina...
Have to talk to your vagina.
And they all get anthropomorphized and they have conversations to each other and it's really, really
and
weird.
And then there's the cat.
Like a really disturbing mental picture.
Yeah. And and his penis as well. She has chats to that sometimes.
It's in the next room.
Yeah.
Is he called Ralph?
I think she calls it like Little Simon or something.
Little Simon. Well, you know that's
how they're having conversations like and independent that, of her. And I'm like, this is not a cute gimmick anymore. I'm not sure where that's coming from. And there's a couple more texts where this happens. It happens a little bit in the Gabrielle books, but not so much because they're more about Gabrielle's stupid angst and Julia being so wispy that it's like a slight breeze can carry her away. And heavy-handed literary allusions.
I'm disappointed, though, in that in fan fiction, no one takes that scene where they rip the baby out of his stomach because I would love...
Yeah, no, Christian Grey do that to Anastasia Steele.
It would be a medical.
It would definitely be erotic medical. Paranormal.
Has anyone done erotic medical? Erotic medical?
I don't know. Medical's not really my area. But oh, God.
That's a whole new genre.
That's a porn fetish.
I kind of don't want to know if that exists, to tell the truth.
It probably does. Everything under the sun exists.
Yeah, that was Rule 34. If it exists, there's pornography of it, you know? There's a wonderful piece of, like, pseudo-fan fiction on the internet called Growing Up Cullen, all about what Edward does while the rest of them are off having sex. And, spoilers, it's scrapbooking. I'll find it and put it on Twitter for you because it's awesome. Hysterical. My friend Hannah, I think, showed me, and oh my god, I was just on the floor.
Is that Hannah? Of the, I want to pat your jumper.
Yeah, yeah. Oh. So I hate you, but I long to pat your jumper.
When's that coming as a shift from fan fiction into something real?
That would make me so happy. I don't know if that would.
Anti.
But then I think this was written before Breaking Dawn came out, and then Bella asks Edward in Breaking Dawn what he did while everyone was having sex, and he's like, ooh, ooh, ooh. And it's like, it's true, it was scrapbooking.
I knew it.
Like, it's, I don't want to say banal, but like, not very much happens in this piece of fan fiction. It's all like just Emmett messing with Edward and stealing all his scrapbooking supplies. It's hysterical.
I always, my problem with, is it book? Which book was it where she gets a paper cut? Book two.
Two, yeah. And Jasper comes at her.
If she gets a paper cut and you go crazy, when she gets her periods, you must go feral. And I'm like, you go past the women's toilets, you must just, like, salivate like snow tomorrow.
So you're applying realism at that point.
Yeah, that's where the power is.
The ceiling was kind of... Where did you, like, kick it out?
Sparkly vampires were cool. But...
Yeah, but...
I do keep a vomit list, so these bodily functions really, really fascinate me. And I've heard that Fifty Shades has a tampon scene, yes?
Yeah, yeah, and oh, yeah.
And I must say, period...
Which doesn't seem to have appeared, does it appear anywhere else? Has that been paralleled anywhere?
No, I haven't seen that anywhere else.
Well, that's a deficiency, because I reckon they'd be having oral sex a lot during that time of month. Surely, if you were Bella, you would expect that as your right.
Though he's so puritanical, he probably thinks that is useless, naughty and wrong. I'm sure they only ever have sex in the missionary position in the dark.
And then when she's a vampire, doesn't all that stop anyway? She's a vampire.
But in general, in YA sort of paranormal, I always think, you know what? you've hit the jackpot. Vampire boyfriend. It's just perfect. But going back to Moose and Boone, I'm pretty sure that I've read at least a couple where they've actually had sex while it was that time of month. And I'm sure they did, because I clearly remember it, because obviously I found it really dirty at the time and fascinating.
Or you made it up.
No, I'm pretty sure I haven't made
it up.
Does
it happen in Crossfire books? I feel like it might happen in the most recent one, but so little happened in that I can't really
I have to say remember. That third book is a bit of a wash for me, because
The only scene I really remember is when they have sex in the nightclub.
Yes.
Nightclub sex is always so hot.
Not like being in the nightclub, but really adjunct room tonight.
Going clubbing. I used to imagine, I'm like,
are we looking out for where is it all happening?
No, I would, like, could you get it up among these people? Like,
on a heaving
and if
dance
you were
floor.
A girl, would you be comfortable? And the answer was never really yes. I'm like, Bess is really gross.
Yeah, sticky dance
and
floors.
And it's dark, and when it's dark, you don't want your bare ass touching anything where you can't tell that it's clean.
Yeah.
So I'm like, it's better left as a fantasy.
Yeah, good in theory.
I don't think anybody ever lays down during it. It's always standing up.
No, yeah. And I read a Maya Banks, I think it's Sweet Addiction.
Yeah.
And it's the one where she ends up with two guys.
Yeah.
And she has,
that's so sweet.
Super sweet. Like, you won't believe. It has, I think it's strawberries on the cover. Oh. Berries! the boyfriend owns this nightclub, and then she dances with these three other guys with his permission, because he's the dom. And then, like, she gets felt up. She's like, this is so hot. And I'm like, no, it's not. It's sweaty and gross, and people stink around you.
I've just read the most recent Maya Banks in the Breathless trilogy, and I had such a problem with it. The hero is this, like, incredibly rich, incredibly powerful CEO, and he's, like, 38. Heroine is 23, and she's homeless. And the power differential in that really, really bugged me, because she basically ends up with no life outside of him. He, like, gives her an apartment and, like, does everything for her. And considering she's been on the streets, you'd think she'd be quite street smart, but she's very fragile. And
so that's deep Cinderella.
Yeah, very, very...
Is 50 the mother of all the new Dom sub books?
I don't know. I think you can't say that it's not, but I think it's probably a bit insulting to say that it is. I think maybe so, it's like so the aunt we, or the okay. the second cousin.
Because were they there? Because were they there before? Or do we, no, I'm trying to work out the relationship between them. But they were there before. I'm sure they were already kind of there, but nobody knew they were there.
I mean, I'm sure more of them have been written now because of Fifty Shades. Yeah. But I'd be pretty uncomfortable pointing to a specific set text and saying this that, would not that was exist the mother of those, because Fifty Shades doesn't really do anything new. No. It's kind of a happy accident of marketing.
Come on, tampons.
Yeah, but I mean, even that's just not new, no, really. There's nothing revolutionary happens in Fifty Shades of Grey. And I think one of the reasons, that's probably one of the reasons for its popularity. Cause
except someone fresh out of school gets a job in publishing.
Yeah.
It's pretty revolutionary.
And she doesn't have an email address. And she doesn't or a computer.
Seriously, she goes to interview this, like, man who doesn't have 10 minutes to spare for an interview, and she doesn't even Google him before she goes in there.
I don't think she knows what Google is.
And then she falls flat on her face. I'm like, really?
And then she's like, how do I find out more about BDSM? And he's like, Wikipedia. It's
like... I love it.
Oh, she's so dumb. Like, and... Just that's where I draw the line with realism. I can accept his extraordinarily unlikely wealth and all that, but the fact that she has gone through university and does not have an email address.
So what?
That's where I draw the line.
That's an odd standard. You can accept his extraordinary wealth.
Yeah, well, because that's
not
kind of
her idiocy.
Well, I think that's kind of because that's just such a Harlequin Presents trope, the ridiculously rich hero. Yeah,
so we've become inured to that.
Yeah, but it's specifically. That she doesn't have an email address and doesn't seem to know how to use a computer and yet has come through 4 years of university with a 4.0 grade point average. That's just a logical disconnect I can't reconcile, you know?
Because it's in the specifics, whereas his wealth is in the noise.
Yeah.
We never really know
specifically
where that came from. I'm interested to know, so 50 was like an explosion following Twilight's explosion.
Mm.
Is there a direct link or does it just finish... And something else somewhere else becomes the new.
Yeah.
And what was the big thing before Twilight? I don't even remember what the
Harry
big thing
Potter.
Was. Yeah, different audience though.
Yeah, but it's the YA market.
There's yes. There's the Mocking Games.
The Hunger Games is in there as well.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think.
But I can see that like the Hunger Games and Divergent and that's a kind of stream out here.
Yeah.
They're not they're in that utopian dystopian.
Yeah.
Urban framework, not kind of in the pure romance thing,
because
they've got plot and structure and other stuff going on, as opposed to romance being the central theme.
It's really interesting. I'd say probably the five like best selling texts, well maybe six. Maybe we have to include Dan Brown here with the Da Vinci Code.
Okay.
But you've got in kind of the last decade, you've got the Da Vinci Code, Harry Potter, Twilight, The Hunger Games, 50 Shades, and Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Right.
And I'm not sure if you can draw a straight line between those texts. And I think the only really obvious one is between Twilight and 50 Shades. And that's a very obvious one because of the fan fiction thing.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I don't know if there's going to be, like, if 50 Shades will morph into something else. I don't know if there'll be another direct line there. Because that's quite unusual.
No, as you've described it there, that is unusual.
Yeah.
So... I'm kind of wrong to be looking for the next one of those because that might have been a one-off, historical one-off.
Yeah, well, I think it's incredibly hard to predict patterns in the broader publishing industry, really. Yeah. Or even in, you know, within genres.
They have enough trouble in the local publishing industry.
Yeah.
So, I
wonder if it's going to die off. I actually feel like it might be dying off soon.
I think it will come back with the movie.
No, but I mean this trend of sort of...
Super bestsellers.
Multi-book romances with strong sexual content. It just feels so saturated to me.
Surely it'll wear it out.
They're basically throwing it out there and then trying to see which books will appeal. And it's not, the understanding of who is reading these books is not as strong as with paranormals. You kind of knew
who
was
the audience
romance
was.
Readership.
Yeah.
It was the crossover with science fiction fantasy.
And it doesn't have an anti-fan community really so much, paranormal romance, whereas I think the anti-fandom of 50 Shades is so potent. And I think it would be really wrong to underestimate that.
Do you think that touches their core readership?
I was just going to ask.
No,
that.
Well, I think a lot of people are hate reading it. Like, a lot of people. I mean, I have no way of telling how many. Like, that would involve lots of surveys and sociological stuff.
Yeah,
that,
for what reason did you read this text?
I don't really know how to do. That's kind of not... I don't do that stuff where
that's
you
kind of in the
do
any,
surveys.
That's kind of in the any publicity is good publicity basket yeah. that says, if you're getting attention, you're getting attention.
And if
whether
you,
it's
if
negative
they buy
or
the book, whether or not,
yeah.
whether
yeah.
because they
care whether
they read
it or not.
They love it.
Yeah, we don't care. Yeah. Kind of, we've made the sale kind
yeah.
of thing.
It's
and it hasn't affected the spawning. I think that's the thing that's the most interesting is the Twilight 50 onwards spawning of
yeah.
dominant themes that you're saying,
yeah.
surely we've worn them out by now.
Well, I'm feeling like it, because if they're tapping into fan fiction that had already been published, it
yeah.
feels to me like they're recycling existing work.
Like,
yeah.
well, there's one that's kind of, that's being published in a month or so, I think, that started life as Bella Swan Justin Bieber fan fiction. So I feel
sorry?
Like they're kind of scraping the barrel
oh
there,
God.
You know?
Maybe
so
that's
sorry,
the intersection between
about Bella Swan
porn and musical.
And
Justin
Bieber. Yeah, I mean, obviously the names have been changed in the
but
published version.
That's who they're meant to be.
Where did I read? I think I read about this on Dear Author, actually.
Do they do any
new deal? Oh, yeah.
Do they do any scrapbooking in that particular?
Oh, I don't know. I hope so. I hold a great hope for the scrapbooking. You know,
that's so funny.
Seriously, if Stephanie Meyer wrote about Edward scrapbooking her, I would revise all the mean things I've ever said about Twilight and just be like, "Lady, give me a high five. That's awesome."
So, who knows what she's doing next? What is L. James writing next?
Ah, well, she was planning, I think, at one point to do Christian's point of view. I really hope that she doesn't
really
do
find that exploitative. I mean, not her specifically, but rarely do I find it done well.
Yeah.
That same story, same
yeah.
time, different point of view.
I mean,
have you done the Colleen Hoover one?
No, but actually that's in
whatever
my radar.
They are. One Hopeless and I don't know what the other one's called.
I did the one
you?
Beautiful Disaster, is it? That's got the one from the hero's
yep.
point
I've
of view as
that.
Well.
Travis?
Yeah. And,
yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I didn't like the heroine's point of view, so it was probably a mistake to read the hero's point of view. But it's just yes, this phenomenon of retelling. It's like, come on now, no, that one's done.
It's
well,
like,
I thought this was a new wave of stuff. This seemed to me
yeah.
to be a new wave of.
It's
Colleen Hoover's
yeah.
done it. Abby Glantz has done it.
Yeah.
So there's a new pattern of we write the first person female,
yeah.
and then we write the same story again from the.
Going back to my favourite subject, Mills and Boone. In the 50s, they instituted this policy called Lubbock's Law after a literary critic called Percy Lubbock, which dictated that they all had to be in the heroine's point of view so the reader could
right.
identify.
Yeah.
But then there was this push gradually more and more from readers that they wanted to know what the hero was thinking.
Yeah.
And so then you get the... Like,
the dual point of view.
Yeah, the dual point of view begins to emerge in, oh, when it's like the 70s, this starts to happen and
right.
it starts happening more and more and more. And so I think this is kind of mirroring this shift. Everyone's... kind of like, tell me more about the hero, tell me more about the hero. And they go, oh, what can I do?
Are there any M&B written entirely from the male's point of view?
Not that I'm aware of.
Oh, I don't think so.
I think it would be...
You say that, oh, I don't... So. What, are we saying women wouldn't read a book entirely from a male point of view?
No, I'm saying I don't think Harlequin would publish it.
Because they don't think women are going to read it.
Yeah,
the
well...
Ultimate, the ultimate reason, I guess. Because that's essentially what these
yeah.
spin-off books are doing, entirely
the,
male
yeah.
point of view.
Well, Kinsale starts... Is it Prince of Midnight? Starts almost entirely from the hero's point of view, and you really don't really get into the heroine's head till a solid quarter of the way
is that,
through. Is it Prince of Midnight? It's one of Kinsale's. She yeah. talks about it in her essay, In Dangerous Men and Adventures.
Was he the one that she thought was a massive war hero?
Oh, I can't remember.
Oh, no, that was Olympia. That
yeah.
sees the fire. Where she thinks he was a war hero, but actually
he wasn't.
Jumped off the ship. He was like a badly ship.
He's a deserter.
It's been so long since I've read it. I remember it's the first one that just had Fabio in the front instead of Fabio and some chick. And,
okay.
And,
but
I remember it because it's in Kinsale's essay, In Dangerous Men and Adventurous Women, and she makes some interesting points about it.
What I was going to say was in the 90s, they used to have a special, like, Man of the Month or something, book in, I think it was Temptation.
Yeah.
And it would be the man on the cover, and it was very hero-centric.
Yeah.
And then you would get...
Much
like,
more of the
would,
hero's
It would start at the hero's point of view, if I
right.
recall.
Right.
And so the story revolved around him much
more
than normal. But
yeah.
this... Huh. My problem with this point of view of, like, the girl's point of view and the guy's point of view...
Yeah.
First, I find it a bit voyeuristic.
Yeah.
But I think that might be just be a trend that we're getting into, where... readers just really want to know more, and because we can give them, you know, we have digital publishing now, self-publishing, it's
yeah.
easier to give them what they want.
Yeah.
And so we do. But the other thing is, it's like, if you're going to decide on first person, there must be a reason for it. If you're going to, if you want both points of view, then you shouldn't be writing in first person.
Yeah.
You should maybe
yeah.
just write the story once.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
figure out whose point of view should be
yeah.
in which...
Yeah.
Well, they look like entirely commercial decisions based on
wow.
the first books were so successful.
Yeah, well, I'm sure they
had such an audience, probably had their own fan fiction, rather than abandon
yeah.
the storytelling to others, bring it back,
yeah.
author another book, pop it out. Mm. And it probably, I don't know, it'll be interesting to see how well they do.
Yeah.
I can't even remember the title for it, but I know both of those authors,
yeah,
Hoover and Gines, have done it.
Because so I feel
it seems
like
we'll see more of it.
I feel like the Beautiful Disaster one didn't do so well. I feel like, I don't know about sales, but I feel like people were quite disappointed in it. Is it called Walking Disaster, the second one?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. So, yes. And the hero is like an underground like fighter.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
And his name is Travis.
That's exactly right.
And her name is Abby Abernathy?
I can't remember her name. I can't remember his name. So, yeah.
And I remember he calls her Pigeon, and he gets it tattooed on his wrist.
If not a guy called you Pigeon, wouldn't you drop him like a hot potato?
He has some reason for it. I can't remember what it is. He's very... I didn't like him very much. I found him very frustrating and kind of paternalistic, which...
From memory, that was a self-published...
Oh, you sound like you've never read a Harlequin present in your life.
And I've read like 80 bazillion.
But that's kind of saying something, right? That you've read so much of those kinds of tropes, and then there's something about this that you just can't sort of really accept.
Yeah.
Maybe people have a trope limitation and they can only...
I think I'm kind of oversaturated. Maybe when I finish my thesis and stop reading so many Harlequin presents, then maybe this will become more palatable to me. But, like, the one thing that I can't stand in text is a teacher-student relationship. I can't deal with that at all. That's my problem with the Gabrielle books. And I think maybe this whole, like, fetishized power difference kind of, like, that's a problem for me because of that dynamic.
Well, that's your problem with Beautiful Bastard.
But I think that this is where this intersection between fan fiction authors and romance authors blurs, because romance authors largely are self-mentored, group-mentored in an insular community. So yeah. RWA will mentor their writers, and in Australia, the way you mentor each other is very similar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
and what you're saying is that'll happen around the world in various chapters.
Yeah. It's kind of you hand down the knowledge that you've gained about how it could work the best. Yeah. In fan fiction, it's free for all. Yeah. It's you create this, we kind of, the fans help you mold it, and you come to this thing. So those things that we look for in a Mills and Boone, the fact that the power is so imbalanced in the beginning, but that they work towards,
And the woman,
you
the
have
woman
to show
wins.
That the woman, wins at the end. Yeah.
She lived, it's her world. They live in the demisexual world.
But the fan fiction author does not have this kind of structure that they feel they really should include in their books. So then they produce these books where you get the romance plot, you get the sex as part of the romance, but you don't get some of the, it's not really themes. It's, I don't know what you would call it. The character arcs that we would expect.
Yeah, I think
that's probably
right, because that's the thing that's hard to create a growth journey for a character.
I think also it's hard to create in parallel with the other stuff that you're already having to manage.
That's right. That's right. Because those things aren't elements by themselves. They are reflections and pieces of the growth journey. So they only exist because of the character's arc. In fan fiction, they exist because they exist. They're not part of any other structure.
And I think when you're writing serially, it's very difficult because when you're releasing in bits and pieces, once you get to the end, it's not like you go back and go, now I need to tie what I did at the end to the beginning. Yeah. You don't get that unless
you
do a
back,
major
do
revision when you publish it.
And this is why I think so much published fan fiction is erotic as well, because that's how pornography was published in the 19th century. It's about instant gratification, which is why...
Episodically almost.
Yeah, well, if you think about the original readers of 50 Shades were reading it not as a book, but chapter by chapter.
You need,
the amount of sex scenes kind of makes sense because they want gratification within every episode.
And I don't think it's even just gratification. I think in each piece that you release, there needs to be like an ebb and flow. There needs to be a climax, and then you lead to a cliffhanger so that people are hanging out for the next one.
Which is like a TV series episode.
And the easiest way to do that in an intense way is with sex.
Yeah.
Unless you're doing suspense where people get kidnapped or murdered. But if you're doing like, once a month, you couldn't get them kidnapped 12 times.
I think it's interesting to watch what's happening on Wattpad as well. So many young people...
Writing
their first stories and watching them on Wattpad because it's free and it's simple technology and it's easy to use and it's really clever.
Yeah.
And just popping it up there for the world to see, but in a more structured format and in a more owned format. This is my whole story. And you can see the fan fiction there. You can see the classic kind of there are Bieber stories intersected. Yeah. There are all of those things that you were talking about earlier, and it's all kind of there on Wattpad alongside established authors using that forum to seed text and release text. It's utterly massive. It's just so deep, the content that's up there, and so variable and so instantly accessible. All of our readers now are becoming their own writers, which is an interesting sort of pressure on an actual writer. And it's the instant feedback on, I've just put a chapter up and there's instant feedback on my Wattpad channel about that chapter. So I can go and alter it instantly if I want to before I write my next instalment. It's quite a different way of looking at authors, because I can't see how that system won't grow a new breed of authors who, going back to your RWA nurtures its authors, its romance authors. This is a different nurturing system altogether, and they'll come think fan with a different
fiction,
tradition.
Yeah. Fan fiction has created its own way of writing.
It has. And I have no judgment about whether it's better or just different, but it'll create different content that we're not seeing now.
Well, it already has.
Yeah.
And that's the end of my meandering conversation with Ainsley and Jodie, and also the last in our series of launch episodes for the podcast. If you've enjoyed the conversations so far, you can help support us by leaving a review on iTunes or just telling your friends to tune in. The audio for this podcast was produced by Rudy Bremer. Also feel free to shower her with adoration for her magical audio powers. Don't forget that if you want more information on the books we talked about in this episode, or if you'd like to catch up on episodes 1 to 4, you'll find everything you need at bookthingo.com.au/podcast. Also, feel free to send your feedback or suggestions to podcast@bookthingo.com.au. Next, I'll be chatting with Australian author Shona Husk about her books, including her awesome rock star romance series called Face the Music. Until then, I hope you have a great month of reading.